Introduction. Vladimir Putin says he is a religious man, a great supporter of the Russian Orthodox Church. If so, he may well go to bed each night, say his prayers, and ask God, "Why didn't you put some mountains in Ukraine?" If God had built mountains in Ukraine, then the great expanse of flatland that is the North European plain would not be such an encouraging territory from which to attack Russia repeatedly. As it is, Putin has no choice. He must at least attempt to control the flatlands to the west. So it is with all nations, big or small. The landscape imprisons their leaders, giving them fewer choices and less room to maneuver than you might think. This was true of the Athenian Empire, the Persians, the Babylonians, and before. It was true of every leader seeking high ground from which to protect their tribe. The land on which we live has always shaped us. It has shaped the wars, the power, politics, and social development of the peoples that now inhabit nearly every part of the earth. Technology may seem to overcome the distances between us in both mental and physical space, but it is easy to forget that the land where we live, work, and raise our children is hugely important, and that the choices of those who lead the 7 billion inhabitants of this planet will to some degree always be shaped by the rivers, mountains, deserts, lakes, and seas that constrain us all, as they always have. Overall, there is no one geographical factor that is more important than any other. Mountains are no more important than deserts, nor rivers than jungles. In different parts of the planet, different geographical features are among the dominant factors in determining what people can and cannot do. Broadly speaking, geopolitics looks at the ways in which international affairs can be understood through geographical factors. Not just the physical landscape, the natural barriers of mountains or connections of river networks, for example, but also climate, demographics, cultural regions, and access to natural resources. Factors such as these can have an important impact on many different aspects of our civilization, from political and military strategy to human social development, including language, trade, and religion. The physical realities that underpin national and international politics are too often disregarded in both writing about history and in contemporary reporting of world affairs. Geography is clearly a fundamental part of the why as well as the what. Take, for example, China and India, two massive countries with huge populations that share a very long border but are not politically or culturally aligned. It wouldn't be surprising if these two giants had fought each other in several wars. But in fact, apart from one month-long battle in 1962, they never have. Why? Because between them is the highest mountain range in the world, and it is practically impossible to advance large military columns through or over the Himalayas. As technology becomes more sophisticated, of course, ways are emerging of overcoming this obstacle. But the physical barrier remains a deterrent, and so both countries focus their foreign policy on other regions, while keeping a wary eye on each other. Individual leaders, ideas, technology, and other factors all play a role in shaping events, but they are temporary. Each new generation will still face the physical obstructions created by the Hindu Kush and the Himalayas, the challenges created by the rainy season, and the disadvantages of limited access to natural minerals or food sources. I first became interested in this subject when covering the wars in the Balkans in the 1990s. I watched close at hand as the leaders of various peoples, be they Serbian, Croat, or Bosniak, deliberately reminded their tribes of the ancient divisions, and yes, ancient suspicions in a region crowded with diversity. Once they had pulled the peoples apart, it didn't take much to then push them against each other. The River Ibar in Kosovo is a prime example. Ottoman rule over Serbia was cemented by the Battle of Kosovo Polje in 1389, fought near where the Ibar flows through the city of Mitrovica. Over the following centuries, the Serb population began to withdraw behind the Ibar, as Muslim Albanians gradually descended from the mountainous Malisia region into Kosovo, where they became a majority by the mid-18th century. Fast forward to the 20th century, and there was still a clear ethnic-religious division roughly marked by the river. Then in 1999, battered by NATO from the air and the Kosovo Liberation Army on the ground, the Yugoslav-Serbian military retreated across the Ibar, quickly followed by most of the remaining Serb population. The river became the de facto border of what some countries now recognize as the independent state of Kosovo. Mitrovica was also where the advancing NATO ground forces came to a halt. During the three-month war, there had been veiled threats that NATO intended to invade all of Serbia. In truth, the restraints of both geography and politics meant the NATO leaders never really had that option. Hungary had made it clear that it would not allow an invasion from its territory, as it feared reprisals against the 350,000 ethnic Hungarians in northern Serbia. The alternative was an invasion from the south, which would have gotten them to the Ibar in double-quick time. But NATO would then have faced the mountains above them. I was working with a team of Serbs in Belgrade at the time and asked what would happen if NATO came. "We will put our cameras down, Tim, and pick up guns," was the response. They were liberal Serbs, good friends of mine and opposed to their government, but they still pulled out the maps and showed me where the Serbs would defend their territory in the mountains and where NATO would grind to a halt. It was some relief to be given a geography lesson in why NATO's choices were more limited than the Brussels PR machine made public. An understanding of how crucial the physical landscape was in reporting news in the Balkans stood me in good stead in the years that followed. For example, in 2001, a few weeks after 9/11, I saw a demonstration of how, even with today's modern technology, climate still dictates the military possibilities of even the world's most powerful armies. I was in northern Afghanistan, having crossed the border river from Tajikistan on a raft, in order to link up with the Northern Alliance, NA troops who were fighting the Taliban. The American fighter jets and bombers were already overhead, pounding Taliban and Al-Qaeda positions on the cold, dusty plains and hills east of Mazar-i-Sharif in order to pave the way for the advance on Kabul. After a few weeks, it was obvious that the NA were gearing up to move south. And then the world changed color. The most intense sandstorm I have ever experienced blew in, turning everything a mustard yellow color. At the height of the storm, you couldn't see more than a few yards ahead of you, and the only thing clear was that the American satellite technology, at the cutting edge of science, was helpless, blind in the face of the climate of this wild land. Everyone, from President Bush and the Joint Chiefs of Staff to the NA troops on the ground, just had to wait. Then it rained, and the sand that had settled on everything turned into mud. The rain came down so hard that the baked mud huts we were living in looked as if they were melting. Again, it was clear that the move south was on hold until geography finished having its say. The rules of geography, which Hannibal, Sun Tzu, and Alexander the Great all knew, still apply to today's leaders. More recently, in 2012, I was given another lesson in geostrategy. As Syria descended into full-blown civil war, I was standing on a Syrian hilltop overlooking a valley south of the city of Hama and saw a hamlet burning in the distance. Syrian friends pointed out a much larger village about a mile away from where they said the attack had come. They then explained that if one side could push enough people from the other faction out of the valley, then the valley could be joined onto other land that led to the country's only motorway, and as such would be useful in carving out a piece of contiguous, viable territory that one day could be used to create a mini-statelet if Syria could not be put back together again. Where before I saw only a burning hamlet, I could now see its strategic importance and understand how political realities are shaped by the most basic physical realities. Geopolitics affects every country, whether at war, as in the examples above, or at peace. There will be instances in every region you can name. In these pages, I cannot explore each one. Canada, Australia, and Indonesia, among others, get no more than a brief mention, although a whole book could be devoted to Australia alone, and the ways in which its geography has shaped its connections with other parts of the world, both physically and culturally. Instead, I have focused on the powers and regions that best illustrate the key points of the book, covering the legacy of geopolitics from the past, nation-forming, the most pressing situations we face today, the troubles in Ukraine, the expanding influence of China, and, looking to the future, growing competition in the Arctic. In Russia, we see the influence of the Arctic and how it limits Russia's ability to be a truly global power. In China, we see the limitations of power without a global navy. The chapter on the United States illustrates how shrewd decisions to expand its territory in key regions allowed it to achieve its modern destiny as a two-ocean superpower. Europe shows us the value of flatland and navigable rivers in connecting regions and producing a culture able to kickstart the modern world, while Africa is a prime example of the effects of isolation. The chapter on the Middle East demonstrates why drawing lines on maps while disregarding the topography and, equally important, the geographical cultures in a given area is a recipe for trouble. We will continue to witness that trouble this century. The same theme surfaces in the chapters on Africa and India-Pakistan. The colonial powers used ink to draw lines that bore no relation to the physical realities of the region and created some of the most artificial borders the world has seen. In the Middle East, an attempt is now being made to redraw them in blood. Very different from the examples of Kosovo or Syria are Japan and Korea, in that they are most ethnically homogeneous. But they have other problems. Japan is an island nation devoid of natural resources, while the division of the Koreans is a problem still waiting to be solved. Meanwhile, Latin America is an anomaly. In its far south, it is so cut off from the outside world that global trading is difficult, and its internal geography is a barrier to creating a trading bloc as successful as the EU. Finally, we come to one of the most uninhabitable places on Earth, the Arctic. For most of history, humans have ignored it, but in the 20th century we found energy there, and 21st century diplomacy will determine who owns and sells that resource. Seeing geography as a decisive factor in the course of human history can be construed as a bleak view of the world, which is why it is disliked in some intellectual circles. It suggests that nature is more powerful than man, and that we can go only so far in determining our own fate. However, other factors clearly have an influence on events, too. Any sensible person can see that technology is now bending the iron rules of geography. It has found ways over, under, or through some of the barriers. The Americans can now fly a plane all the way from Missouri to Mosul on a bombing mission without needing to land to refuel. That, along with their great aircraft carrier battle groups, means they no longer absolutely have to have an ally or a colony in order to extend their global reach around the world. Of course, if they do have an airbase on the island of Diego Garcia or permanent access to the port in Bahrain, then they have more options, but it is less essential. So air power has changed the rules, as, in a different way, has the internet. But geography, and the history of how nations have established themselves within that geography, remains crucial to our understanding of the world today and to our future. The conflict in Iraq and Syria is rooted in colonial powers ignoring the rules of geography, whereas the Chinese occupation of Tibet is rooted in obeying them. America's global foreign policy is dictated by them, and even the power projection of the last superpower standing can only mitigate the rules that nature, or God, handed down. What are those rules? The place to begin is in the land where power is hard to defend, and so for centuries its leaders have compensated by pushing outward. It is the land without mountains to its west, Russia.